Hey guys, I'm Adam Rapport, and this is the Bon Appetit Foodcast. All right, first up, we are still recording remotely, obviously. I'm awaiting professional-grade equipment to make our podcast sound as awesome as they usually do, so bear with me as the pieces arrive via Amazon, like kind of day by day. Pretty soon we'll have our own proper remote studio. In the meantime, this week we are checking in with contributing writer Priya Krishna, who's also in a remote location, but that is not her apartment in New York City. She has some interesting travel adventures. So we are seeing how Priya is doing. And then we're airing an episode we taped in studio in New York a few weeks back with Andy Baragani about the recipes he developed for a story in our March issue that is all about cooking with more acid. All right, here we go with Priya Krishna. Priya Krishna, how are you?
I'm doing okay. Just like living like I'm in high school again at my parents' house.
Yeah, I guess that's the more important follow-up question. Where are you?
I'm in Dallas. I came here a little while ago for my dad's birthday and for a wedding, and then I didn't leave.
Yeah, so explain when you traveled there. And I know when we were at work, you were debating, should I go? Should I go? Is that point when the coronavirus was starting to escalate that it was unclear whether or not to travel, and what was your thought process and how did you decide to go?
Yeah, I mean, like, we were getting so little information as to whether travel was okay, not okay at that time. It was, let's see, it was Wednesday the 11th. Yeah, I think that was Wednesday. Yeah, and so it was supposed to be my boyfriend Seth, my sister and her husband. My sister and husband live in London. And so they were like, international travel seems like a definite no-go. So they canceled their trip. And then Seth was supposed to come on Friday. And then basically what happened was I took off on Wednesday. By the time I landed, the travel ban had happened. Tom Hanks had coronavirus. The NBA season had been canceled all in the course of my flight. Yeah.
That was like the most active like day on Twitter. Everything just happened at once. And it was like, oh my God. And that's, I think, when the coronavirus really obviously people are like, oh, this is enormous to our lives.
And I basically landed in Dallas at that moment. And I remember looking at my phone, having like 20 text messages and being like, I may not be going home for a while.
So are you like literally sleeping in your high school bedroom?
Yeah, I'm in my high school bedroom right now because I'm worried that my dad is going to come upstairs and yell something that interferes with this podcast recording. Just like hiding in my room as I used to do. I'm literally doing my work from my desk that I did my high school homework from. And the other day I called it homework and my mom had to remind me that like, this is my job. I'm not doing homework.
Oh my God. So yeah, if you follow Priya on Instagram, which is at PK Gourmet, you will notice that you do a lot of cooking with your parents, both your mom and dad. So how has that been going? Like, how do you divide up the turf in the kitchen? Who's in charge? Who's the chef? Who are the sous chefs? How does this all work?
I mean, I'm definitely not in charge. Like, I've tried to cook. And the only time my mom let me cook is when I had to cook because we were filming video for, like, the test kitchen video. Other than that, my mom has taken full control and we basically assumed our duties. It was my job to set the table and like clean all of our surfaces. And I just like reverted into that mode. I set the table. I like clean the counter off. My dad does the chopping and the dishes. And my mom is sort of the captain.
You're like fully in seventh grade again.
I'm fully in seventh grade. I'm even like, I don't have any books to read. So I'm reading like the young adult novels on my bookshelf.
Okay, so it's interesting. So your father, who has appeared in your videos on the Bon Appetit YouTube feed, is a kind of like a FaceTime presence. What's his and your mom's relationships in terms of kitchen mates? Is he her helper? Does he cook his own dishes that he likes to make? How does that work?
He's definitely the helper. He chops. He's really, really great at chopping. He like sharpens his knife before every use. Like, he's very legit as a chopper. He does all of the dishes and he's very particular. He has a specific way he cleans all the wine glasses. Like, he has a system. I appreciate it. And he'll do his own cooking during the day. Like, he makes bread, he makes our yogurt. So he'll do that during the day, but like starting around 5 o'clock, it's my mom's domain and kind of no questions asked.
Let's talk about a few of the dishes that you've cooked since you've been home and you've shared on your Instagram stories and the kind of the ones that have been your favorites and maybe why they're your favorites.
I mean, the first thing I asked my mom to cook when I got here was gardi, which is this dish that I just did a video for. We just released a recipe for. And as soon as we released the recipes, I was getting tagged like every day in like 10 to 20 new posts of people making it. And I was just getting extremely hungry. And it is like, I don't think we planned for this, but it is a really pantry friendly dish in that it's just spices, yogurt, chickpea flour. You don't need any fresh produce. You eat it over rice. It's very comforting.
Do you try it as a soup, as a sauce? Like, how do you put it into context for someone who hasn't had it before?
I mean, I feel like I described it as a soup and every brown person on the internet got so angry with me. So I don't even want to classify it. It's beyond classification. I'll call it like cozy blanket it's like a soup meets a sauce, uh-huh, meets like a gravy. It's like a coating for white rice, basically.
But it's served cold or hot?
It's served hot.
Yeah. I remember having it in the test kitchen. A, it's one of those, I hate to say it, but in this Instagram age that we live in, it's an incredibly photogenic dish. Mm-hmm. Like the swirls of it, of that sort of really bright yellowy orange, and it's just like, oh my god, like it's just asking for that overhead shot. I love how bright and tangy it is flavor wise.
Yeah, it's so good. And honestly, like my mom's version reminded me that when I cook something in the test kitchen, I'll get 90% of the way there, but there's like that 10% of mom magic.
What do you think she does maybe that you didn't do when you were doing it yourself? What is, can you put your finger on what that mom technique is? Because I think we all know it. Like, anytime my mom cooks something, I'm like, why does this have like 15% more flavor than when I do it? Is it just salt, or like what does mom do that I'm not doing?
It's not salt. It's not cook time. It's the exact same way that I make it, but somehow hers is better. I truly have, like, I could not put my finger on what my mom does that's different. I think she just has the intuition of having made this for so many years, whereas I turn the heat up to high, set the timer, and then like walk away and come back, whereas my mom is sort of tending to it and not setting any timers and sort of it's done when she says it's done kind of thing.
Can you spell the recipe so people can search for it?
K-A-D-H-I.
Yeah, and it's on bonappetit.com right now, and you just go to the recipe section and you'll find it there. And that's kind of like a nice, flavorful, vegetarian, vegetable sort of option. Are you more of a meat family or a fish family, would you say?
We are a vegetarian family. So I've basically
fully,
just...
Fully okay.
Yeah. So I basically just like adjusted to life as a 100% vegetarian, which has been very interesting.
Yeah. What is that like? Because that's something that... Obviously, there are people who sometimes like are not vegetarian, but then they start dating someone who's a vegetarian, and all of a sudden their diet changes very much. Has it been difficult, or is it one of those things like after a while you're like, oh, I don't even miss meat anymore, or do you have cravings?
I mean, I was vegetarian for the first like 21 years of my life. Oh, so
okay, good sidebar.
I've always said like if you told me I couldn't eat meat anymore, I would not miss it. And that's kind of been my experience here. It's been really easy to fall back into this routine of not eating meat. And even at my apartment in New York, I basically created a rule for my boyfriend and me. We don't cook meat at home anymore, like with rare exceptions. Just, you know, it's like restaurants do it better. And we felt like it was better for the environment for us to just do our part and cook mostly vegetarian at home. And so that part has been really easy to adjust to. It's always funny when people cook, like pitch like vegetarian packages for the magazine, like, oh, now that we're all quarantining, we're eating vegetarian. I'm just like, that's just my state of being.
One thing that was dawning on me this weekend as I was trying to think about what to write for my newsletter that I have to owe our producer, Emma, end of day today. And I still haven't written yet, Emma, sorry. Yeah, we are now a nation of home cooks. And so you mentioned about not cooking meat, eating it only if you go out. Right now, none of us are going out.
Yeah.
And what has that been like, being at home in your high school bedroom with your parents eating three meals a day at home and not being able to go out?
I think I had to create boundaries, which was important. Like, I think that was sort of the first thing we talked about when I was like, I'm going to be here for a while, which is like, I'll take my breakfast and lunch on my own time and we don't have to eat all these meals together.
Before. Yeah. Did you communicate that to your parents or did that just kind of happen?
Yeah, I did. I explicitly talked about it with them. Like, we're going to go insane if we try and do everything together. So we need to accept our alone time. I also try really hard to get out of the house once a day. I will like download an episode of a podcast and just take a bunch of laps around my neighborhood listening to it. And sometimes I run into my dad or my mom on their walk and I'll do like one lap with them.
But you don't pretend like you don't see them. You just kind of walk by them or just, what's up, sort of head nod.
I do have to say there's a guy who lives down the street, or his parents live down the street. It's like this guy I had a huge crush on in high school, and his parents walk their dogs whenever I go for my walk. And I like still feel like residually high school embarrassed seeing them.
Oh my God. That's awesome. I do think that's important for all of us now as we sort of adapt to this at home lifestyle is establishing some sort of schedule. And we were talking about that on the work front, that it's important to take a work break, because otherwise you can just be in Zoom meeting after Zoom meeting and doing this and that. I think it's important on the professional level. It's also important with your spouse or mate or kids or whatever, that there is some sort of structure to your day, because the hours can just bleed together otherwise. And I think that's great advice, sort of setting some parameters and being explicit about it is great. What is your mom's, you know, we talk a lot about pantries right now in the food business, especially this past week that we're all at home, and things you can just reach for as a home cook. What is your mom's pantry like compared to your pantry back in New York?
I didn't realize this until I came home. It's exactly the same. I have subconsciously modeled my pantry after my mother's. Like, it's crazy. I did not anticipate this happening, but I came home and I was like, oh, my staples are exactly the same. This is like being in my own pantry minus like my boyfriend's baking equipment.
As a Indian-ish cook, and that's the name of Priya's cookbook, if you guys want to go buy it, Indian-ish, you can order it online now.
Thanks, Adam.
Always pitching. When you say staples, what staples pop to mind?
Lentils, like 10 varieties of lentils in our house at any time.
Varieties of lentils. I think, so right now there's so much bean talk on the internet and there's a lot of attention paid to different types of beans, from the gigante ones to those flageolets, all these different types. When you think about types of lentils, what are the main different types of lentils you think about, and what do you use each for? If you want to give me like three examples.
Yeah. So I think of lentils sort of in terms of thin to thick, with like the thin ones being sort of the quick cooking, easy soupy ones, the thick ones being the sort of more buttery, a little bit more texture heft, maybe a bit more versatile lentils. So usually at the end of the spectrum, you've got pink lentils, super thin. You can find them at most grocery stores. I love the Goya brand.
Okay.
And those cook in like 5 to 7 minutes. You can throw them into a dal. You can use them to add heft to a soup. They're my like, you know, I'm starving. I have no time. I need food now. In the middle, go ahead.
No, raising my hand on Zoom. Do you just, in terms of cooking 5 to 7 minutes, are you just throwing them in boiling salted water?
I put them in like about 3 to 4 cups of water, a spoonful of turmeric, a spoonful of salt, and then I just let them cook. And then I'll temper some spices and ghee and throw that on top as a finisher. Okay. That's kind of my go-to. But if you're already cooking a soup and you just want to cook the lentils directly into the soup to add just like a little bit of texture, a little more, to make them a bit more filling, this is a perfect candidate for that, because you can put them in right at the end of cooking and they'll cook super fast, like kind of like putting rice noodles in soup.
Oh, so you're saying you'll put the dried lentils directly into the soup and let them cook for the 5 to 7 minutes in the hot broth?
Yeah, they just cook so fast, you don't have to worry about them.
Yeah, so make more of a quote-unquote meal out of the soup.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, they're just so thin and quick cooking, they can do that. And you don't have to plan ahead. You can just be like, oh, this is looking kind of soupy or it's kind of liquidy. Maybe I want a little more texture. I also love mung beans, which are sort of those green and white beans. And you can use them to make khichdi, which is a sort of what would I call it? God, I hate when I have to classify. It's like a porridge-y type of a dish where you cook the lentils and the rice in the same pot, and it sort of creates this really wonderful starchy pot liquor-y, like delicious porridge. And those kind of, those cook for a medium amount of time. I think we do like 10 to 15 minutes on those. And those have a really nice, like soft mush that just feels very satisfying in your mouth. They have a lot of texture on the outside. They have a shell that comes out. It's just, they feel very nutritious when you eat them. They don't taste like rabbit food at the same time. They've got a taste. They have this like nice earthy taste unto themselves.
Can you spell Khichdi?
K-H-I-C-H-D-I. I feel like it. One of the things that drives me crazy when people pronounce it like Khichdi, it's Khichdi.
Good thing we're doing a podcast so you can hear that. Okay, before we let you go, is your house a dessert house?
It is not, but I'm making it a dessert house. That is something that I am doing, because literally my parents eat, it's insane. We have a bar of chocolate in the fridge and a bar of chocolate in the pantry because my mom likes room temperature chocolate. And my dad likes cold chocolate, and that's what they eat for dessert. And I was like, this is ridiculous. So I found pie dough in the freezer that my boyfriend Seth had left last Thanksgiving. And I made a pie this weekend, and it was like, I could breathe again. We were eating real dessert.
Oh, real dessert. What kind of pie did you make?
I made this 420 Blackbirds salted caramel apple pie, but then I made like an oat crust on top because we didn't have enough pie dough. It was really good.
So yeah, so Priya's partner, Seth, is quite the baker. Did you FaceTime with him to get any sort of baking tips as you were making it?
Yeah, actually, I used the tripod that the BA video team sent me to film our videos and just put my phone there. And it was like being in a virtual baking class. He was telling me like, no, that dough's too thick. You need to roll it out this way. You've got like a hole there. He was like literally giving me live advice.
That's
like, you can monetize this, Seth.
I'm about to say, just because like, yeah, pie dough is one of those things when you read about it in a recipe, they're like, oh, do it until it's the texture of this. But you don't really know unless you know. And having someone coach you through it, I imagine, must be super helpful. Speaking of videos, for the BA YouTube feed, I think we have our first sort of at-home introductory videos going up this Friday. And then next week, we'll start rolling out the videos that you and Andy and Molly and everyone else have shot in their own home kitchens. That I think the quality is going to be surprisingly good. At least that's my feeling.
We'll see. I feel like my thought the entire time I was shooting this was like, oh man, we are all so bad at tech and the video team must think we are just like idiots.
No, it makes you charming. just so I know there's a lot of fans of your dad out there on videos. Does he make an appearance in this video?
He makes a lot of appearances. Whether I've asked him to be in the video or not, he kind of just pops in.
We might have to get him to sign up for the Screen Actors Guild. Anyway, Priya Krishna, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, and good luck in Dallas.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Andy Baragani, I feel like as home cooks, we often talk about seasoning. Is the dish well seasoned? We never talk about acid.
No, we don't. We don't. And that's why we ended up doing one of my favorite stories I've ever worked on, a story of how we need to be using more acid in the kitchen.
For the home cook, what does that mean?
That means, well, acid comes from a lot of different things. I think a lot of people right off the bat, they think They think of citrus, they think of vinegars, but the reality is acid can come from dried fruit or dried shrubs like barberries, sumac, tamarind. These are all different forms of acid that will make your mouth pucker.
And I do hear it a lot, like professional chefs. I've always liked that notion. You see like a line cook with their tasting spoons and they taste something and there's like, needs more acid, and they walk away.
Well, I find that, like, imagine, like, you use salt to really extract the flavor from ingredients, and fat carries flavor. Acid does this thing where it really provides balance. You know, it makes a dish more well-rounded, I find.
I find it kind of wakes up a dish.
Absolutely. It brings it back to life. Like, yeah. Like a slow-cooked, braised short ribs or lamb shoulder or a fatty piece of steak. You know, I don't want a big bone-in ribeye with, like, so much excess butter on top. I almost want, like, a little bit of a splash of vinegar.
Yeah. All right, before we get into your story, needs more acid, and these delicious recipes in the March issue of Bon Appetit, give me some basic tips about how to incorporate more acid into my home cooking in ways that I might not be thinking about other than just a lemon wedge.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say, like, in the most basic form, it's like you when you're making a salad, I think old school method of like doing the 4-to-1 ratio of
3-to-1.
A 3-to-1 ratio. Is it 3-to-1?
It's 3-to-1 oil to acid, which I think is insane.
That is insane.
It's just so fatty.
So fatty. I would play around with adjusting that. Vinegars are definitely more sharper and more acidic. Like they vary between vinegars. Rice vinegars are a lot more delicate than, let's say, a sherry vinegar or a red wine. Mm-hmm. Lemons have a high pH level, so it can be very, very acidic.
I like to do, I'm probably like at a 1-to-1 ratio now. Mm-hmm. Like I like a lot of acid in my dressings. I also, one of our salad stories we did, maybe it was Jody Williams and Rita Sodi from their bunch of restaurants over in the West Village. I think they mentioned using a variety of acids, not just one vinegar, but do some lemon juice and a rice wine vinegar or red wine. Like mix it up a little bit. Get a little complexity in there. And I always like to do shallots, and the shallots take on a nice pickled element when you just let them soak with the acid, mm-hmm. and maybe a little sugar or salt.
That was one of my rules from a while back on the podcast of like my 10 cooking rules is combining different acids.
Oh, I'm sorry. So you're taking ownership of this? Yes. This is not Jody Williams.
That was definitely a tip on my 10 cooking tips. I do think like combining, whether it's like a little bit of sherry with a little bit of lemon juice or grapefruit with rice vinegar, it makes a more interesting, complex dressing overall.
You mentioned like having a ribeye steak. Sometimes like you'll see, I know like in some Italian restaurants, I don't know, I feel like it's a very 2000s thing. You get like the charred, sliced, you know, ribeye, aged ribeye, and then they'll do like the little drizzle of aged balsamic on there sort of like sweet acidic thing, which I'm like, okay, you know what I'd rather have? Give me the charred, juicy, well-marbled ribeye with some malt and salt, and then a really acidic sort of vegetables or side salad on the side of like fresh, you know, whether it's shaved fennel or grapefruit or this or that, like something that puckers to play off that richness.
Absolutely. Give me like, I mean, I love having like a crunchy salad to go on a fatty piece of meat, whether it's like a pickled salad, which is included in the magazine, or just like a charmoula or salsa verde or romesco that is like packed with good citrus and vinegar.
What do you define a charmoula as?
Charmoula is a North African condiment, traditionally usually served with seafood, but I think it's a sauce that can go with, or sauce and marinade that can go with a lot of different things. I would treat it like any other green sauce, to be honest.
I had a delicious one by our chef friend, Gerardo Gonzalez, who made a tomatillo charmoula.
Love.
That was so good. So let's talk about some of these recipes and how you incorporate acid. I'm staring right now at the pasta with brown butter, whole lemon, and Parmesan. Mm-hmm. Did you have to email Allison Roman to get permission to use the whole lemon?
I don't think I'm going to give anybody credit for the whole lemon.
You're not giving anyone credit for anything.
No, well, the whole lemon thing, I think, like, I don't know. People don't own lemons.
Well, I don't know. I'm going to text Allison and see what she says.
I only have love for her, so it's fine.
I always think lemon juice, whole lemon, how does that make this dish more complex or interesting than a squirt of lemon juice?
Well, I've done a lot of pasta recipes. Some have had lemon juice, some have had lemon zest, some have had both. And the juice provides that acidic, puckery flavor. The zest provides this kind of almost like sweet floral note.
Yeah, but more zest is more fragrant than anything.
Absolutely, definitely really more nice. Fragrant. When you use the whole lemon like you're doing here, where you're cutting it into rounds and kind of caramelizing it in butter, in brown butter to be exact, you get all of that plus the bitterness from the pith, which I find kind of make it a little bit more adult, more mature. Bitter is that kind of flavor that, you know, is misunderstood. But
it's kind of like a bittersweet because it does caramelize, and you slice it you slice them crosswise really thin.
Yes, and also the butter itself does kind of cut the bitterness from it.
You make sure to get rid of the seeds, right?
100%. You have to.
What I like about this dish, and it was delicious during tastings, was sometimes you get those, like in a lot of Italian restaurants, you get those sort of like pumpkin ravioli in the brown butter, and it's so rich and so sweet. You want something acidic, or you want something a little bitter to balance all that brown butter.
It also, I find like those dishes, while I've enjoyed them in the past, they only tend to have like one texture. And with this, you're using it just pasta, salt, lemons, butter, and Parmesan and pepper. And you get the, like, obviously the al dente pasta, this beautifully emulsified sauce, but then you get this kind of caramelized, slightly chewy lemon and the kind of powdery Parmesan to finish.
You have a sidebar on sort of other acids that aren't lemons and vinegar. Your Persian background. I went to a Persian Hanukkah celebration of sorts.
And
dried lime. What's the dish? It was a stew with like tons of greens and some braised chicken.
It's called Ghorma Sabzi.
Yes.
Typically made with red meat, but it is definitely, there are variations and you could make it, use a chicken, but it has dried limes in it.
And the dried limes, I was like, whoa, you're like, what was that?
You don't want to bite into it.
Okay, well, I did.
No. Because they're incredibly bitter and astringent and musky. Yeah.
So you avoid them, but they infuse the dish with their certain something something.
So dried limes, typically they're seasoned with salt and then set out to kind of shriveled out in the sun. And they come in different colors, from kind of a paler, almost beige color to a brown, which is my favorite, and then to a very, very dark, almost black. And the darker it gets, the more astringent, musky, and it can have.
And so when it's in a stew or a soup, it sort of releases its flavors into the liquid?
Yeah, I prick it a little bit with like a paring knife, and then I add it to a stew or a braise or a soup. And then while it goes, I kind of just push it down to kind of get all the kind of all that flavor out of it, and then throw it away.
Speaking of soups, this is my favorite dish in this story. Grains in herby buttermilk. And this photo is just like mesmerizing. Just the greenest of green, frothy sort of milky substance with these like sort of like farro poking through and a little drizzle of oil. And
I knew exactly what I wanted. This is a dish where I knew exactly how I wanted it to look like. I just didn't know how the flavor would be.
Okay.
I really didn't know. I was like, it kind of visually, I knew I wanted this kind of bright green broth, and I wanted the grains kind of floating and like a little pools of oil. My reference was a soup that is made with yogurt. You'll see around the Middle East called soup-e must. Must means yogurt in Farsi. And you'll see people, when they're incorporating yogurt into soups, hot soups to be exact, they'll whisk the yogurt with a little bit of egg and a little bit of flour so that it doesn't split and become grainy. I didn't do that in this case. Instead, I pureed a lot of herbs to get that green color.
Yeah, you called for 1 cup of dill fronds and 1.5 cups of parsley leaves.
Yeah, the parsley definitely helps with the color. And then I did a combination of two dairy products, the yogurt.
Question.
Yes.
How packed or not packed should a cup be when we talk about a cup?
I don't pack it hard. Mm-hmm. Because if that was the case, then I would specify. I think we cut the whole like loosely packed or packed because of you.
Don't try to turn around on me. It's served hot, cold? Is it room temp? How do you see it?
It's served hot, but you can have it room temp.
It looks like a good summer soup.
It can definitely be a good summer soup. You could chill the broth before you add the yogurt and buttermilk and just add it once it's cold and have like a nice summer soup.
So yeah, so it's 4 cups of water with the onion and garlic, lemon zest, all the herbs, and so then that thins out all the buttermilk and yogurt.
Exactly.
Yeah, I just found it such a refreshing, but also I mean, healthy-ish, but because it's got all that buttermilk and yogurt, there's still a richness to it.
There's still a richness. Originally, I was just going to use buttermilk, but I found that the consistency to be a little bit too thin. So the yogurt gave it a little bit more body.
Yeah, and I think it made it satisfying. Apparently, you want me to talk about the whole tamarind glazed black bass with coconut herb salad.
Yeah, I really love this dish. I mean, I love this dish, but Molly, when she tasted it, she's like, this might be one of my favorite things that you've developed. And I kind of, that hurt my feelings.
What are you hurt? That's so you.
It's like, no, I was just like, really? Like, but it is a very, it's a very easy dish for someone who's never cooked whole fish before. Uh-huh. I mean, I would say, like, you're using a kind of maybe an ingredient that you're not too familiar with, which is tamarind concentrate. Tamarind is an item that comes, like, in a pod, and you could buy it and just kind of suck on it and then just kind of toss out the seeds, but you'll also see it in like, a block form that's a pulp. You'll see it in jars where it's, like, a syrup, a thick, almost molasses-like. Yep. It can be incredibly tangy to actually kind of sweet and fruity. In this case, I made a glaze with caramelized tomato paste, garlic, honey, add some sweetness and tamarind.
And you sort of, it's almost like the fish, the whole fish on a sheet tray, they look almost like shellacked.
Yeah, yeah.
And then festooned with all this coconut and red chilies on there and little mint leaves.
Yeah, I wanted it to be festive and I wanted it to be kind of like, when you roast the fish, I wanted this tamarind glaze to get really sticky and just concentrated. And then I just want to kind of add a lot of texture to it in the form of crispy shallots, toasted coconut, mint leaves, and the chilies, and obviously more acid in the form of lime wedges.
And you sort of score the fish before roasting, and then once it's done, you just sort of pull it off the bone, and that glaze mixes in with the flesh, and it's delicious. I feel like, should I be using more tomato paste in my life? I don't know if I should.
I think you should. I mean, I'm definitely someone who, like, I love tomato paste. I find that, like, you just have to cook it out properly.
Yeah, explain that.
That means that when you're adding, whether it's a tablespoon or you're doing, let's say, BA's Best Bolognese, which I think called for, like, a third of a cup or half a cup.
Did you develop that recipe?
I actually did develop that recipe.
Okay, sure.
But you really want to cook it out until the tomato paste darkens, like, a shade or two, and it begins to stick to the bottom of the pot. You want to remove any of that kind of tinny flavor you get, just like you would with a can of, let's say, whole peeled tomatoes.
And that sort of adds a kind of a nice base note to, like, a stew or something, maybe a sauce. Essentially, Molly Boz and I were developing a top secret BA's Best recipe. And we were making tomato sauce, and it was interesting doing just the canned crushed tomatoes with a little olive oil and garlic, and then the canned crushed tomatoes with olive oil and garlic, but starting it with the tomato paste first.
Which one did you like more?
It depends. I mean, it depends what the dish is. I generally like a really sort of fresh tomato sauce.
You wouldn't want
the paste. I don't mean like fresh tomatoes, but I mean canned tomatoes that are crushed and just really simply just warmed up with olive oil and maybe a little garlic. So I don't love that tomato pasting. But certain dishes, as you said, if it is a earthier, richer, beefier dish, then you actually do want that. So I think a lot of it depends on what it is you're looking for and what it is you're trying to accomplish.
Absolutely. I think it does give you that kind of depth that it has that, it tricks you into thinking the sauce or the dish has been cooking for hours upon hours.
Apparently America loves chicken for dinner. So last recipe. Oh, you've got some charred citrus in this recipe also.
Yeah.
Tangy vinegar chicken with barberries and orange. Very pretty dish.
It's a very, I do love this. And this is, I mean, very much a dish that I grew up with some variation. This is kind of like the chicken you would have with a rice dish. It's a rice dish mixed with barberries. So you see the barberries in the rice with butter, and it's called zedesh. Zedesh means barberry, so zedesh polo. And you have a chicken to go along with it. And the chicken usually has, like, turmeric, onions. You might sneak some barberries in there, and it's just, like, has a very savory, earthy note to it. Not necessarily as acidic as this dish. This dish, it does, while it looks like that chicken that I'm talking about, it has the addition of vinegar. And I think a lot of people are familiar with, like, vinegar chicken, where you're kind of cooking chicken slowly or marinating the chicken in vinegar. And it has a really kind of bright, acidic taste to it. With this, it's a little more balanced with, like, the sweetness of orange juice. I think there's a little bit of sugar and the earthiness of turmeric. All kind of combined together and slowly braised.
Also, with something like vinegar, if you're starting with vinegar as it cooks, the vinegar kind of leans more sweet than acidic eventually, or as opposed to a splash at the end.
Let's say, I think there's half a cup of vinegar in this. Is that correct? That is, yeah, a third of a cup white wine vinegar. So the pH level is never going to change, but it's going to get less acidic because not so much that it's reducing, but more that you're adding sweetness from the orange juice, you're adding turmeric, and these are qualities that are kind of tame the acidity.
Gotcha. Going back to barberries, you mentioned, you say half cup dried barberries or dried tart cherries.
Yes, and I mean, look, I'll fully admit, like, they're two wildly different things. Barberries are quite acidic, are very, very tart, and while sour cherries are tart, they're not nearly as tart. But I find that it would be a great, a welcome addition as well.
If you and look for barberries, where will the shopper typically find them?
Obviously, you can order it online like you could anything these days. But I would go to look for a Middle Eastern market. You'll see barberries in used in a lot of different Middle Eastern countries or Middle Eastern cuisines and Central Europe, Eastern Europe.
Any online markets you recommend when people are looking for ingredients like barberries or good quality spices?
I mean, I would look into Burlap and Barrel. I think they ship at this point, and they're doing just an incredible job at bringing some really unique spices and all kinds of stuff over. But maybe Sahadi ships out in Brooklyn.
Okay. Andy Bergani, Needs More Acid in the March issue of Bon Appetit. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Adam.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced and edited by Emma Wertzman, with additional programming help from Carrie Polis and Elise Inamine. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wertzman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to reach out to us about this episode or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.